What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. The total amount of student debt is now $1.3 trillion, and another $100 billion will be added by the end of this graduation season. The average amount of debt that students are graduating with is $30,000, and many have as much as $50,000 to $100,000 or more in undergraduate loans. Those who go to graduate or professional schools can easily add $200,000 to $400,000 in debt. Joining me via phone is Jordan Goodman. He's in Westchester, New York. Jordan is the author of The Ultimate Guide to Student Loans. He offers a wealth of knowledge on the management of student debt for parents and students. Jordan, welcome to 411 Teen.
Great to be with you, Dr. Liz.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm so looking forward to talking with you because the information that you are sharing is just really invaluable. Student financial aid consists of, I would guess, paying tuition fees, living expenses, room and board, transportation, books, supplies, all of this occurring at either a post-secondary education institution, or a professional school, or a community college, four-year college, or university. Is that correct?
Yes. Now, financial aid typically means loans.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Grants and scholarships which you don't have to pay back, and financial aid typically is loans, either private loans or federal loans. Sometimes it can be loans from the colleges themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people say, oh, I want to qualify for as much financial aid as possible. It's not an honor. It's a burden, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'd much rather get scholarships and grants that you don't have to pay back than loans, which are a burden. I mean, federal loans today are 30 years. Typically, the interest rate is about 5 or 6%, and it's changing society. Exactly the numbers you said, the average student is graduating with about $30,000 in debt.
Mm.
Many people, $50,000, $100,000, you know, way more than that. And graduate school, several hundred thousand more than that. This is changing society in a major way. People getting out of school today have such a burden of debt that many, many of them cannot afford to live on their own and have rent their apartment, buy cars, kind of start families. They got to go back and live at home. The latest numbers I saw, Dr. Liz, were that 50% of the people graduating are going back and living at home again, what I like to call the boomerang generation.
Right.
They keep coming back.
Yeah, and that is very distressing, I'm sure, for them and for the parents.
Right. They thought they had an empty nest.
Right.
And it was
right.
Only 4 years, sometimes 5 years. In many cases, people cannot get the classes they need in 4 years because they're so overcrowded, and so it takes them 5 years, sometimes even more, to get through school, adding even more debt to the situation. And then they get out, and hopefully they get some kind of a decent job, but if they don't, the income that they're earning is pretty much going towards the student loans, and again, this is a 30-year obligation. So it's an enormous problem for an awful lot of people, and I think it's growing every year. As you also mentioned, this graduation season we're going through right now is going to add about $100 billion in new student loan debt to be paid on top of the existing $1.3 trillion. So these are enormous numbers. It's also become a political campaign issue as well.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders particularly made a big deal of it on the campaign trail, saying he wanted tuition to be free, basically, on all public universities. Hillary Clinton said she wants people to graduate with no student loan debt. Nice idea. I don't know how
right.
that's going to happen.
Well, that was my next. I was going to ask you. That's my next question. How realistic is this? It doesn't seem like it's very realistic to me. Okay,
that's putting it mildly.
Yes, yes.
I mean, to do that, they would have to allocate billions and billions of dollars that does not now exist to make schools tuition free. Now, there are some private schools that have very wealthy alumni and endowments that do provide aid, kind of need-based aid, as they call it, or even you know, everybody gets it. But that's a select few colleges, and it's only because they've got huge endowments. There's a big squeeze going on right now, particularly in the middle-level colleges that have pretty high tuitions and do not have big endowments, mm-hmm. and the pool of students is shrinking, and they're not able to make these payments. The latest numbers I saw, there are 150 schools with tuitions over $60,000 a year right now, or private. And the recent, Sarah Lawrence in New York recently went over $70,000. So that's, they're leading the vanguard to higher and higher prices. And it's just crushing an awful lot of people mm-hmm. and changing, as we mentioned, lifestyles dramatically.
Dramatically.
And in the past, they had some student loans that wasn't so bad. They could kind of get on their life. Now, in many cases, they cannot do so until their late 30s.
All right. Well, just for the listening audience, do you mind clarifying the difference between need-based and merit-based?
So merit-based is based on your grades and your SAT scores and, you know, kind of the financial, the academic merit that you've achieved in high school. Need-based is more based on the finances of you or your family's situation. So there are two separate things. You can get scholarships based on having gotten high SAT scores or mm-hmm. grades, and that's not related to your family's financial situation. Your family might be doing quite well, but you still get merit-based aid anyway. Needs-based aid is based on your family doesn't have much money, you don't have much money, so you're going to be getting it based on financial needs. So those are two separate ways of getting financial aid.
Is there a particular formula or prescription that you promote that one should follow to avoid major financial difficulties when it comes to college and paying the bill?
Well, the best way to do it is to save up front.
Okay.
The way I like to put it is every dollar you can save or invest mm-hmm. is a dollar you don't have to borrow when you get to college. So there are some very good tools. I mean, in Florida, you've got the Section 529 plan, the Florida plan,
right.
where you can put in, I think it's up to $5,000 a year. As long as the money is used for college tuition, room and board, and college expenses, it comes out completely tax-free. So that's a good thing. And you can invest mm-hmm. it in mutual funds and, you know, all kinds of good choices. And the younger you start, the better it's going to get. So a lot of people put something away for college, but nothing close with the kind of tuition levels we have today to fund the full amount. So the book you mentioned I did called The Ultimate Guide to Student Loans, the first third of that book goes through all the different options to invest to try to avoid getting financial aid when you get to college. I hear from this people all the time, they say, oh, I don't want to save or invest because that means I get less financial aid if I show assets. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I would think that that would be really positive there.
But they say, oh, no, I want to get as much financial aid as possible.
Oh.
Like, you want to take on as many loans.
Many loans.
Mm-hmm. You know what you're saying? They kind of think of financial aid as like you've won the prize or something. You know, it's like you've won 30 years of debt is what you basically won.
Well, I have a ton of questions here that parents have asked me to share with you.
Sure.
First of all, one of the questions was, when do you start? Number of parents asked them, when do you start? And by that, you know, because money management, wise money management is a key. So do you start with as far as your kids are concerned, do you start with them having a checking account? How do you prepare kids even to manage their money once they get in college?
Well, hopefully there's been some training before they get
right,
to college.
Right, right.
Well, in many cases, there is not.
Mm-hmm.
I have a son who's now 26, and actually he had a group of guys that he kind of hung out with, and I did a session with them when they were like juniors in high school where I literally brought out a checkbook, and I had them write each other checks and keep a balance of a ledger and deposits and withdrawals.
How many could do that?
This is the first time I've ever done that.
Okay, that's what I was asking. How many could do that correctly?
None of them.
Uh-huh.
they didn't know you had to sign a check. They didn't know you had to sign on the back to deposit it. It was a completely new idea. Their parents had always taken care of these things.
Right.
So as basic as that sounds, get people some experience. Even when my son was much younger, when I'd go to the bank with him, I'd have him deposit money to show you how you have to put money into the ATM. It's not just the money tree, the money comes out. You've got to go both directions. You know? So from pretty early on, he kind of got that idea. So giving them practical advice on how to, and implementation of these things makes a big difference. How to write checks, how to keep a balance, fees. Now, you really can't open a checking account in your own name until you're 18,
mm-hmm.
but you can do it as what's called a Uniform Gifts to Minors Act account when they're younger, and the parents may have to co-sign or put their names on as kind of guardians. But the more you can expose these things to kids, the better it's going to be. There's a lot of kids that don't have a clue about anything in the financial world, and there's a lot of kids that are really into it, and their financial education going on in schools. There's something called the Jumpstart Coalition, a nonprofit group. Jumpstart.org is their website. Loads of financial education of all types aimed at younger people. So if your school doesn't do it, that doesn't mean you as a parent can't do it and teach your kids about these things. I find, and I'm very big in the whole financial literacy world. I really want people to learn about these things. I find that a lot of teachers don't want to teach personal finance because they don't want the students asking them about their own debts and their own student loans and their own problems and how did you invest your 401k and all those kind of things. So
they avoid it.
They will avoid it. It's true. So here you go through life. You know, you're building up these huge debts. You don't know how to invest. You don't know how to write checks. And then you get your first job when you're like 23 or something, and they hand you a 401k packet that's got 50 choices in it. It's like, well, you figure out where you should invest. I mean, it's like learning a foreign language instantly. You know, it's completely foreign to most people. And this is when they've got, on top of that, these huge debts, $30,000, $50,000, whatever it may be on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we are not doing a good job at getting young people ready for the real world, so to speak, as far as their financials. I've actually done seminars. My son went to Dartmouth, and I did a seminar for the students of Dartmouth. I love doing those kind of things. And these are like, you know, honor students and math majors and economics majors. They had not heard of any of this stuff. You know, credit scores, how to get a mortgage, how to rent your first apartment, investments. This is like a completely new world to them. And so there's a lot needs to be done, unfortunately, in this area, Dr. Liz.
Well, what is your position on credit cards? And on credit cards?
Well,
I think because
the law changed in 2010. Mm-hmm. Before 2010, which is called the Card Act, people under age 21 could get cards on their own name. And so they'd go to the football games and the baseball games, and they'd have these tables out there and sign up all these kids for credit cards, even though they had no income.
Right.
They figured the parents would bail them out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, in some cases the parents did, in some cases the parents didn't. And the average freshman had $5,000 in debt before they even finished their first year. That was the average. Mm. They'd never, you know, you spend a card, you buy your pizzas, the stereos, whatever it may be. And the idea of paying it back or having an income for that was a kind of a foreign idea to them.
We're going to take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, a conversational forum for teens and other interested folks. This hour, I'm talking with Jordan Goodman, nationally recognized financial expert. Jordan, again, we are so glad to have you. In looking at financial aid and student loans and grants, when should one start the application process? I mean, do they really need to wait until they have determined exactly where they're going to school and when they're going to school and that kind of thing?
No. Start earlier than that.
Start
scoping it out like junior year. In fact, if you're talking about scholarships and grants, particularly scholarships, have the kid research these things and maybe starting sophomore year in high school. Okay? Don't just have the parent do everything. Have the kid appreciate this a little bit. So there's lots and lots of scholarships out there. There are these scholarship services, for example. And what you do is you see what the kid's, where he's located, maybe ethnicity, what sport he's involved in, what hobby he's got. You know, remember the 4-H club. I mean, there's a million different scholarships. You've got to see what you have the best chance of getting. And in some of these cases, you're the only one applying because there's, you know, they're so specific. They're a left-handed ping-pong player from Tennessee wanting to go to Oregon State. You know, there's only one person wanting to do that. So you'd be surprised what scholarships are available. Sometimes you have to write an essay. And maybe you have something you have to do. But there are lead times and deadlines for all these things. You can't do this last minute. Don't start the process after you've been accepted to college sometime in the spring of the senior year. Start the whole process much, much earlier. And have the kid be as involved as possible. Don't just have the parents do it.
And that's one of the misconceptions, I think, because they think that they need to have everything in place, where I'm going, when I'm going, before they start the process. So
it's what's called the FAFSA form.
Right.
The federal, basically it's the acceptance form.
Mm-hmm.
You start that process like fall of senior year.
Okay.
And it's a whole complicated thing. And basically the colleges are saying, how much in assets do you have? Give it to us, basically, is what
they're saying. Mm-hmm.
Because there's what's called the expected family contribution, the EFC.
Okay.
Which is after they've looked at your assets, at your stocks, your bonds, and your salary, and your house value, and all the different things, they say, okay, based on the income you've got, this is the amount we're expecting you to contribute. And after you've fainted, then you have to kind of come back and say, how could it possibly be that much? And then the difference between what your expected family contribution is going to be, and that's where the financial aid comes in, which again is loans for the most part. So if you can bring other money to the table through grants or scholarships in one way or the other, it can really make a huge difference.
Well, often folks will feel like the process, and you touched on this a little bit, is just too complicated and too overwhelming. And even though it may be complicated, it can be done. And would you just kind of talk about the application process itself, the FAFSA?
Well, I mean, there are people who specialize in this specific area.
Indeed.
In applying for financial aid colleges. There's a whole little mini industry that helps you get through this thing because it is overwhelming for a lot of people. And how to fill in the FAFSA form. There are some legal things to do and illegal things to do. I mean, for example, assets that are inside IRAs or pension plans are not considered assets for the purpose of getting, you know, the FAFSA form, getting financial aid. Assets you hold outside are considered assets, and particularly assets in the name of the child are even more considered assets that you're going to be spending for college education. There's a lot of tricks to this whole thing. We can't go into it now, although I do go into this in some detail in my book, The Ultimate Guide to Student Loans, and there's a website related to that, theultimateguidetostudentloans.com. But you don't start this thing last minute, like spring of senior year after you're into college. It's much too late at that point. Start earlier.
Well, one comment I've heard parents make is there's not enough aid available to make college really a possibility. And I tend to disagree with that. I think that they can find the money if they really want to go to college. And I wanted to have you respond to that.
I agree with you. And particularly private schools, in many cases, have got large endowments. I mean, I went to Amherst College in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And that's what's called a need-blind place.
Mm-hmm.
So they accept you without knowing anything about your finances. And then once you're accepted, whatever it takes, they'll get you in there. You can put some money in. They'll fund you 100%. It's need blind on the admissions part. So that's a kind of high-end liberal arts college with a big endowment. But there are many ways of doing these things. There are many ways of getting these things funded. It takes some work, and you can't do it the last minute. But if you take, and I'd like it to be a team between the parents and the kids to figure this thing out so they can end up, because the college is really going to make a big difference in the student's life going forward as to what kind of opportunities he has available, and particularly going into a field where they can earn the money
to pay
these loans back.
That's right.
I'm as liberal arts as I get, but you know, you come out of school with like a Greek philosophy major or something, it's like, well, that's nice.
Yeah.
What am I going to do with that?
What are you going to do with it?
So I'm finding it's a big problem. People come out with student loans, but not marketable skills, that they can pay it back. And it's an enormous burden on that. Now, just a few things about student loans. 10 years ago, the bankruptcy bill was passed, and in that bankruptcy bill it said student loans are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. The only two loans, student loans and IRS debt, are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So even if you're behind and even if you go bankrupt, you can still not get rid of those student loans. So they hang on to you forever. And the agencies that call you are brutal. These colleges or the Department of Education hire these collection agencies, and they'll garnish your wages. If you have a tax refund, they'll grab your tax refund.
Mm.
They'll go after any assets you've got. I mean, they are just really, really rough. And it feels terrible to, you know, pay this interest on this history class you had 15 years ago. I don't even remember anything that happened in it. You're still paying interest on it. So it's an enormous burden to a lot of people, and by not preparing up front, as we're talking about them doing, the pain can last for many decades.
Well, what about the misconception that if one has low high school grades, that's going to prevent them from securing financial assistance?
Makes it harder.
Yeah.
It's not impossible, but it's going to make it harder. I mean, the better grades you have, or the better musician you are, or athlete, or scientist, or whatever, you know, if you do better, you're going to be able to get into a better school and get more financial aid. I think there is something to be said for that. If you're at the bottom of your class and you haven't shown much initiative and you don't have any interest in anything, you're not going to get as much financial aid as the people at the top of class who are real achievers. That's just the way it works.
But you may pursue a community college, which may not cost as much.
Correct.
Build those grades up, demonstrate that you are really committed, and that's an avenue that one may take.
A lot of people do that. They'll take the first 2 years of community college and then go into a four-year college for the last 2 years, which actually saves them a lot of money.
It does.
And maybe they're more ready to go into a four-year college. I think there's a lot of people that are going to four-year colleges that are not really ready for it, and either academically or socially or psychologically or financially, and they languish there. And that's why a lot of these people are, you know, not graduating or coming out with huge debts. Also, in the for-profit sector, they've gone to a lot of these schools, like University of Phoenix and other places, that promise the world and don't deliver the world. They deliver a lot of debt is what they do. And they say you're going to have all these skills and all these job offers, and a lot of people are very, very disappointed in the skills they get. And in fact, the Department of Education is going after all of these things as really frauds, because they've got these kind of mills where they have these aggressive recruiters saying, come here, you'll get these fantastic jobs and high salaries, and don't worry about it. And they go, and it's not the experience they have at all.
Another misconception is that you have to be extremely needy to get financial assistance.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the more needy you are, the more chance you have of getting it. But
of course,
you can get, even if you're not financially that needy, but you have good skills or good grades or good sports or good music or good science or something, yes, you can definitely get financial aid. So you're exactly right about that. It's not really based as much on financial need as it's based on, we talked about merit versus financial aid. The merit is often more important. So having your kid do really well in high school really pays off the amount of debt you've got.
This is 411 Teen, and I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me via phone is Jordan Goodman. He is the author and co-author of 13 best-selling books on personal finance. Jordan offers listeners insight to the challenge of dealing with financial aid. You know, Jordan, today I see a lot of students who work more than any other students in industrialized countries. Now, we see that here in the U.S., but a lot of research is indicating that often these students are working for items they want and may not be what they need. For example, you know, certain clothing items, or, you know, living in a particular place. Or so I wanted to, and this is to comment on that. What does it say about our society? Are we as adults sending the wrong message if this is what is happening with our students?
Well, it's kind of an instant gratification society. And everybody wants everything now. They want a fancy car. They want the latest iPhone. They want headphones. They want stereo. They want good food. Vacations. Well, maybe they're not able to get that quite yet, you know?
Right.
In the old days, you'd kind of build up to these things. And you don't get a BMW when you're 18 or something. You know?
Right, yeah.
It's kind of what I call the entitlement culture. It's like they're entitled to it all now as opposed to kind of building up over time. And this can get people into debt, both the kids and the parents. If the parents, you know, there's this whole term they call them the helicopter parents.
Yes.
Right, who are kind of hovering over every moment the kid, and they have since birth, you know, want to make sure they don't fall down and have, you know, they're protected against any kind of possible risk or danger of any kind. Well, you coddle these kids, and they expect all this stuff, and it can add to a lot of debt if people don't have the money to do so. And it's kind of a keeping up with the Joneses thing going on here.
Yeah.
My roommate had the latest iPod, or, you know, iPhone, and I've got one that's 2 years old, I feel embarrassed or something.
Right.
Maybe put up with it already.
Right. Right. Is there a formula that are that you might suggest in balancing needs and wants? Or is there a general practice that you might suggest to parents that may help their students to avoid these pitfalls?
Well, I think we want to work for it. If it's just given to you, you don't really appreciate it very much.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you an example. When I started at age 12, I started at age 9, delivering newspapers in Cape Cod, where I was.
Okay.
So, you know, I'd have a paper route, and I'd be running all over the, you know, I collected money. I remember I'd go to the doorbell and say, collecting, and it was like 25 cents or something,
mm-hmm.
the 60s. But you really have a value of money when you go, you're sweating, and you're
right.
delivering. At the end of the day, your hands are filled with ink and so on. You know, you get an appreciation of money. So I wanted a boat, so my parents matched my contribution.
Mm-hmm.
I remember this was like 1969. The boat, like a Boston Whaler, was like $200. So I earned $100, and they paid me $100. And I really appreciated that boat.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So having a work for it instead of just having everything be given to you, I think will make a big difference. Because right now, as you say, the wants and needs, everything is a need because they got to keep up with everybody else.
Yes.
Well, it's, maybe you can do with not the fanciest clothes or the latest iPhone or whatever it may be.
Right.
And, you know, this is a society where you have advertising, and particularly today with social media, everything is instant. It's all Instagram, Snapchat. Everyone wants everything. You get a date with Tinder, you just, you know.
Immediate gratification.
There you go, you know?
Immediate gratification. That's what we're
totally
talking
about.
Well, you said the best way to go is saving. Is there a percentage? What percentage should one save?
10%. If you can save 10% of your income, that's both for parents and for kids, that would be far better. The average, the overall savings rate in the country is about 5%. But if you can put, and they always say, your grandmother said this and she was right. Pay yourself first,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Put that money aside in something that might earn a little interest for you. Because if you don't pay yourself first, it's never going to happen.
It'll never happen.
And so that if you could put 10% aside of your income and have it grow in something, that would be a good way to get started. And for saving for college, the 529 plan is a good way, as we talked about before, because the money's growing tax-free. Inside an account that you could put at the stock mutual funds and have it really grow on a tax-free basis. So by the time you get to college, you'll have to borrow a lot less.
Okay. Would you make a distinction for the listening audience between a bank and a credit union?
Okay. So banks are for-profit companies typically owned by shareholders whose job is to produce profits for their shareholders and pay dividends. Credit unions are owned by their members, credit union members, and pretty much they're break-even not-for-profit organizations. And as a result, they have much lower fees, much lower interest rates on loans. They might pay a little bit more on savings accounts, that kind of thing. And their credit union's based around colleges. It could be around your employment.
Mm-hmm.
It could be for a military base. You know, there's a lot of different places that you could have credit unions. Credit unions also do not pay taxes, whereas banks pay taxes. So it's kind of the for-profit versus the not-for-profit situation. In many cases, credit union is all you need.
Okay.
So it could be very, very convenient today.
Now, you touched on this somewhat. How do we save? Do we go money markets, savings accounts, bonds? Can you just elaborate a little bit more on the different ways?
I mean, the problem today is that savings accounts, money market funds, checking accounts literally pay zero, and it's going to stay that way for a long time. So you can put the money aside, which is nice, but it's not going to grow for you at all with today's very, very low interest rates. So, I mean, in the long run, the stock market does well. Now, moment to moment, it may be volatile. But if you could do what's called an index mutual fund, that's going to be matching like the Standard & Poor's 500.
Mm-hmm.
And when the stock market goes up, you go along for the ride, basically the 500 biggest blue chips in the country. So you just have to be able to stand the short-term volatility. But if you look over the last 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, whatever it may be, that's the way to go. And an index fund is going to beat most other actively managed mutual funds with very, very low fees. And these are so-called no-load funds, no commission. So you can go to Vanguard or T. Rowe Price or Fidelity or any of these places and get an index fund. And there are index funds inside the 529 plans we talked about as well.
Okay.
So that's another way of having the money grow far more in the stock market in the long run than a savings or checking account where you know in advance you're going to earn nothing.
How do parents teach financial responsibility and money management? Now, I know, you know, you mentioned they need to start early, exposing kids to having a checking account. But is there anything else that you would find
well,
that they really need?
Well, I think by example, I mean, showing them how, and not making it such a big secret.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, I don't know what happened in your case, but the parents don't want to tell their kids about money. It's considered too private, or they're embarrassed about it, or whatever it may be. If you don't know about it, learn about it yourself as a parent and teach your kids, expose them these things. I mean, in first grade, give them a piggy bank and have them put pennies into it or something like that. Teach them to spend, give them an allowance, and if they run through their allowance the first day, they don't get more until the next week or whatever it is going to be. You've got to show them you just can't all spend it at once. But people are going to learn that much more through experience than they are through just telling them that. You know, give them their allowance for $5 for a week, and they went out and bought a lot of candy. It's like, okay. And they come back the next day, I've eaten my candy, I want more. No, you have to wait another week.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything is not instant. You have to sometimes delay gratification, or even better, save it. So I find when you get kids involved in investing, starting about age 10, 11, something like that,
okay,
they really get into it because it's fascinating. It really is. You learn about companies. I've actually done quite a few seminars at schools on these kind of things. And what I do is I show the kids companies that they are in their everyday life and how you would have done investing in those companies. So Nike, McDonald's, Google,
mm-hmm.
Apple, you know, things like that that they can kind of relate to. And then I show them the stock charts. Had you put money in Google 10 years ago, you'd have 10 times your money.
Okay.
And it's something they're using every day. You know, it's something they can relate to because things that they're using all the time.
Hold your thoughts. We're going to take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We'll get right back at you. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holifield, and joining me via phone is Jordan Goodman. Jordan knows everything about finance, and I tell you, he's really sharing with us a number of valuable tips. Jordan, tell us about loans. And when I say loans, I mean the types, whether they're subsidized or unsubsidized.
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of different ones. The federal loans, which is the majority of the student loans, subsidized loans means they're going to be about 5%, something like that. But there's a limit on how much you can get. And then the other part is going to be unsubsidized loans, which are going to be higher cost.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are parent loans, so-called parent plus loans. And then there's a certain level that you can't get any more of those. And then you max out on those, and then you go to private loans, which would be from banks and places like that, which is going to be even higher interest rates. So you want to get as many unsubsidized loans as possible, up to the maximum you get. Now, once you get out of school, there are things you can do to manage these loans. I'm going to be talking about the average being $30,000. A lot of people have way more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So here are some specific things that people can do once they get out of school to manage this whole burden of loans a bit. The first thing, consolidate the loans.
Okay.
Because you might have a bunch of different federal loans at a bunch of different interest rates over different time periods. Consolidate them all into one at the lowest possible interest rate. There's a federal consolidation program through the Department of Education, and there's a website you can find out about how that works, which is consolidatecollege.com, and it's kind of complicated to figure this whole thing out. Even if you're behind, even if you're a delinquent, your wages are being garnished, you can still consolidate your loans. You can only have one shot at it. You can consolidate once.
Okay.
So that's the first thing you can do is a consolidation program. Second thing you can do is what's called the income-based repayment program, the IBR program, where if you meet the criteria, you pay the minimum on your student loans for 10 years, and then no matter how much you owe, the rest of it can be forgiven. So the criteria are you work for the government, state, local, federal, military, post office, any kind of government job. You work in the nonprofit sector, church, foundation, any kind of nonprofit group, or you can show financial hardship. And if you can meet any of those criteria, you can get all your loans forgiven after paying the minimum for 10 years. In those sectors, there are forgiveness programs for the private sector that typically have to pay for 20 years. So that'll help you some. And that website I just gave you, consolidatedcollege.com, you can find out if you qualify for that IBR program. And the third thing you can do, a lot of people don't realize this, Dr. Liz, is you can refinance your student loans to as low as 2%. So there's a company called SoFi, Social Finance, which does that. And a website for that would be SoFi.com, SOFI.com/moneyanswers. And that way they know that I told you about it and you get the best possible deal. So you have some federal loans at 5 or 6%, some private loans are 8 or 9%, whatever, combine them all into one in as low as 2%. And if your credit is good, like 700 or higher, you'll be able to get that and pay them off much more quickly than if you have these bunch of different loans at all kinds of different interest rates, much higher than 2%. So those are three specific things people can do if they've got a big student loan burden to make it a little bit better.
Now, I know the best way to finance college is not to have any loans and to be able to, you know, pay your way through. But that does not always happen. There are also grants that may be available. What's the distinction between the grant and the loan?
So, in many cases, you can do things when you're on campus that will lower your tuition. For example, you can do what's called work-study. You can work in the library, you can work in the dining hall, you can work in the athletic department, you know, do various jobs that will cut down the amount of your tuition. So that's something you can do. You can do internships that might earn you something. So there are various ways to cut down on what you owe to some extent, but you're going to have to do some work for it. It's not just going to be given to you. Grants are given to you based on typically merit, one way or the other. Now, it can be academic merit, it can be athletic merit, it can be ethnic. You know, you're a Scottish knitter who wants to go to Florida State or something, and there's only one guy applying for the Scottish Knitters grant or something like that. So grants are typically issued based on either academic or athletic merit or some kind of ethnicity or some special skill that you might have.
Okay. In your opinion, how much debt for college is reasonable?
Reasonable. Well, it depends on your income. Okay, $30,000 if you're working at Walmart at $9 an hour is not too reasonable.
No.
If you're making $100,000 a year as an investment banker, that's not a big issue. So it's very much relative on how much you're earning.
Well, what if you're I was just going to say, what if you're going into moderately lucrative, I guess, field? I'm asking this because one of the parents asked me, well, how much debt should I allow my child to go into?
It's not something the parent allows their children to, one way or the other.
Okay.
It's a combination of the kids' finances, the parents' finances, and increasingly grandparents are now being asked to put money into their grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing this more and more. Because the parents are maxed out. They borrowed against their home equity line. They've sold their stock portfolio. They're borrowing against their 401k at work. You know, they've kind of cleaned everything out, and they still don't have enough. And so now the grandparents are being asked to contribute to their grandkids' education. So it's not a matter of how much you allow. It's how you're going to assemble the money you need at these very high and rising tuitions. We said 150 colleges, $60,000 a year more. In the public school, the tuitions may be a lot lower, but they're going up at a faster rate because in many cases the states are cutting back on aid to education and therefore more of the burden is being placed on people paying tuition. So it would be nice to say, oh, I don't allow you to borrow more than $10,000, but then you're not going to school if you haven't assembled what you need to make it.
Right. I have seen students and parents use credit cards for loans. Would you comment on that?
That is the worst possible way of doing it, because credit cards are very high interest. It's going to hurt your credit score if you use a lot of credit card interest. I mean, the average credit card interest rate is about 14%, but there's lots of them at 18%, 25%, 30%. Credit cards are designed for short-term borrowing, and ideally you pay it off every month without having to pay any interest on it. So you're right, people do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most highly expensive loan out there. The least expensive would be for home equity lines of credit, HELOC loans, because that's against the second mortgage on your house, and that's going to be secured, and that might be like 4% tax deductible. The next one would be a 401k loan. If you have work, you can typically borrow up to $50,000 on the balance in your 401k. The next one would be life insurance. If you have cash value, you can borrow against that maybe 6 or 7%, something like that. Those would be the three easiest things that people borrow against all the time to be able to be reasonable. But credit cards, worst possible way of doing it. Some people have to do it, but that should be an absolute last resort.
I have seen it happen, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It is not.
One little tip, by the way. Let me give you a place that, if they're going to do that, this is the place they can get the lowest interest credit cards.
Okay.
There's a website called Credit Card Perks, PERKS.com, that has all the best deals, including the lowest interest credit cards, most of which are based in Arkansas, actually. You can get them from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But they have usury ceilings left over from the Depression, so they typically don't charge more than about 8%. So that is a way of getting the lowest interest credit cards if that's the route you have to go.
Now, what we've been talking about and focusing on mainly has been undergrads. And when you go to graduate school or professional school, of course, the bill gets higher. But
right.
What type of what type of financial aid, loans, grants, fellowships, whatever, is available at that level?
Well, the federal government does have graduate school loans as well. Typically, you're going to put those on top of the undergraduate loans you may have.
Mm-hmm.
And the schools themselves, in many cases, will have loans. Now, that, depending on what it is, you have a better chance of paying it back if you're going into something you kind of know you're going to be able to monetize later. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But even so, a lot of people are going to these professional schools and not getting the jobs or the incomes that they thought. For example, I saw a recent statistic that only 43% of the people graduating from law school end up in the law one way or the other. 43%. So lots of them go through a three-year degree for $200,000 or whatever it may be and are not getting high-paid laws jobs in the law firms. Law firms have cut back. Now, the very, very elite, you can make a lot of money, but for many people, they're not making it that way. Same thing with business school. You get an MBA, and in many cases, they're not finding kind of corporate executive jobs, or it's going to take them a long time to get there. Doctors, medical school is what? 5 years at least, maybe more than that. If you have a specialty, maybe another 3 or 4 years after that. You can easily have $300,000-$400,000 in medical school. Because of what's happening in healthcare, doctors do not make as much as they did in the past, at nothing close to it, because the reimbursements are lower and so on. So before you sign up for some kind of a professional school, have a really good sense of realistically what kind of income you're going to be able to get to pay back $200,000-$400,000 in loans, which can hang over you for many, many years.
Are there do they at that level? Do they offer work study type situations?
Not usually, because you're too busy. If you're in medical school, you don't have time to breathe. You're not going to clean tables in the cafeteria. Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, work study is typically for undergraduates.
Okay. So graduates don't seem like they have as many options as undergraduates do, or do they?
I agree with you.
Okay.
The graduates are going to take on more debt than the undergraduates, and they have fewer ways to kind of lower that tuition payment because they don't have time. I mean, it's very intense being in law school or medical school or business school, and you really have to kind of concentrate on it full time. Undergraduates, not quite as intense, and you have time to do work study or, you know, do other kinds of things that can lower your tuition bills to some extent. When you go to professional school, you really have to know what you're doing and have a clear path on what you're interested in. If it happens, I'll tell you my son's story. My son just got a master's degree at Berkeley in data science, you know, kind of big data.
Okay.
And he was very focused on it. He loved it. The tuition was $60,000. But he ended up getting a job. He now works at Airbnb. And he's using all of his data science degrees, and he got a really nice job, and they feed him breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and he gets all kinds of benefits. So, you know, that was an education that paid off. It was $60,000, but it was worth it. But he was very clear about what he was looking for and the skills he wanted. So that's kind of an ideal situation where it can pay off. But if you're kind of not really sure where you're going to go with it, you really have to think twice before you go to professional school and take on those hundreds of thousands in debt.
Well, can you offer any advice as far as the selection of one's major and what area they want to go into? And I know they have to like what they're doing and, you know, be inclined to do it. But didn't you offer any advice as far as those areas that may be good to select for a...
Well, go where there's, you know, there's going to be demand. I mean, there's a big shortage of computer science people.
Right.
There's a big shortage of nurses, right?
Right.
There's a big shortage of kind of practical, hands-on people, plumbers, electricians, tool and die people, because all those people in those fields are now retiring. They're getting into their 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And there's a big shortage of plumbers in this country, you know. So go to a plumbing technical school and you'll do really well. It has to be something you like.
Right.
But before you enter something, realistically say, what could I do out of this that's going to be marketable? And it may be sound too commercial, but that's the reality of it, because you come out with some, you know, arts degree or something, it's nice, but are you going to make enough money as a dancer or an artist to pay off your student loans? Probably not. So it's got to be something pretty practical today.
And if you want to pursue, you know, the arts, then maybe you need to also have a backup plan.
Yes, because arts, you know, how many people are going to become Picasso?
Right.
Berishnikov, or, you know, play violin in the Metropolitan Opera Symphony or something. I mean, it's a very, very small group. And I must say the same is true with athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a lot of people go to school and think they're going to get a big NFL contract or an NBA contract or Major League Baseball. It's very visible, but there's tons and tons of people that don't make it. Most of them, the vast majority
of them don't.
Even when they do make it, their careers are pretty short, 2, 3, 4 years at the most. So it's very visible because you see all these games all the time. But for many people, they go. And when you're an athlete in college, they take over your life. You're an athlete first, you're a student second, as far as I'm concerned. And in many cases, you're not really prepared to do a career outside of athletics. So I think a lot of athletes either get injured or don't end up doing too well because they're kind of expecting the big contract.
Well, they need to hear what you're saying, because I agree with you totally. So often they have, you know, a distorted perception of what is going to happen.
They're all going to be Michael Jordan or something, you know?
No, and
one of them.
That's right. That's right. In these last few minutes, would you talk a little bit about the no-loan financial aid? And I'm thinking of, like, Princeton, you know, years ago became one of the first universities in the U.S. to eliminate loans from their financial aid package. And this,
well, that's true, but there are very few places that do that.
I know.
Schools like that that have enormous endowments.
Right.
I mean, Harvard's endowment, I think, is $36 billion now, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yale's about $20 billion. Princeton's about $15 billion. So that's what it takes, is an enormous endowment that's producing a lot of income that can make it a loan-free situation. So it's nice, but there aren't too many places like that. In fact, it's going the other way. A lot of these kind of middle-level schools and community colleges are having fewer loans and more tuitions going up more because they just don't have the endowments. One of the problems today is that interest rates are very, very low. So endowments are not earning as much as they did before, so it means they have less money to make these kind of situations. So you have to have an enormous endowment to be able to do something like what you mentioned with Princeton.
Right, right. And these were designed really to, if I remember correctly, to attract those students or applicants from the lower socioeconomic backgrounds in reducing, hopefully reducing their student debt load. And encouraging them to come to school, right?
Which is a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a lot of places that they can do that, let's put it that way. A lot of people are going to want to get those situations. I mean, colleges are trying to be as multicultural and, you know, give chances to people who's first-generation college and all that as possible. But it's very expensive to do that, and a lot of colleges are just not able to do that, and particularly on the public sector. Things are really getting squeezed. The schools are overcrowded. It's hard to get your classes. Funding for public education has been going down, so tuition has been going up. So it's a, kind of a rough situation. You really have to think carefully about what's best for you, what your career options might be. As we talked about before, something like community college for two years and then going to a four-year college afterwards may make a lot of sense for a lot of people.
Well, I want to say thank you so much. You just shared so much valuable information with my listening audience. To my listening audience, I want to ask you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.